Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The historian Gregory Aldrete says when the director Ridley Scott's Gladiator opened in 2000, it single-handedly revived the popularity of the big-budget ancient history epic. These days, we see a lot of dudes in tunics and plumed helmets and breastplates. The sword and sandal movies fell out of favor for years, but movies about ancient Rome were always there from the beginning of cinema. Aldrete says, as far as historical accuracy goes, the early ones were pretty uneven, and they established a template for portrayals about Rome that we still see. You know, chariots and centurions and togas. Oh, and gladiators, of course, which brings us back to Ridley Scott's film. Aldrete took us through the opening scene.
This scene, I like how it opens very much. You get this kind of moody depiction of the forest and the nervous Roman legionaries gathering for battle, knowing that the big fight is coming. One of the things I think is really good is that pre-battle sequences. You see the legionaries collecting their equipment, lining up in rows, preparing to do battle with the barbarians.
Will they fight, sir?
You shall know soon enough.
And really, the primary characteristics of the Roman army, what made them special, why they were successful, are discipline and organization. And you see both of those elements in that opening pre-battle sequence.
People should know when they're conquered.
Would you, Quintus? Would I?
Then when you get into the battle itself, at least from a historical standpoint, things get a little shakier.
Archers ready.
Because, of course, the battle begins with a lot of explosions and fire and guys shooting arrows that are flaming. And all of this is stuff that looks good on camera, which is why almost every movie includes them, but almost never happened in real life. There simply weren't, you know, massed flights of fire arrows that people routinely used in ancient battles. They weren't shooting catapults, firing things that really, to me, look like kind of pots of napalm that just explode and set the entire forest, as well as quite a few Germans, on fire. So that's the Hollywood aspect. And then when you get to the battle itself, again, it starts nicely showing the Romans in ranks, which is exactly what would happen. But once the battle begins, you get another cliche, which is that it all just devolves into a kind of mindless melee of swirling individualistic combat, where you have people fighting one-on-one, the Romans seem to forget all their wonderful discipline and just all rush into a mob and engage the Germans. And you get a lot of things that look a lot like kind of Hong Kong kung fu films, which again would be very different from what you would see with a real Roman army, which would be a bunch of guys in a row behind their shields, kind of making chopping and thrusting motions in unison and acting together, acting in concert. The secret to Roman success. And then, of course, you have Russell Crowe as Maximus heroically launching himself, even though he's the commanding overall general, right into the thick of the fray with his war dog, and kind of getting engaged personally in combat, which would not have happened either, but again, is what we expect of our heroes in Hollywood, and just looks good. In scenes like this, what always strikes me is how powerful audience expectations of what something should look like have become, and how much that shapes filmmakers when they come to make new films. I mean, there's absolutely no reason why a filmmaker couldn't, let's say, do a film showing a battle between Romans and barbarians and try to do it in a much more realistic way. Except that by this point, there is such a history of decades, you know, almost 100 years worth of films depicting Romans fighting barbarians. And so there's certain conventions that the viewers have just come to expect. And I almost feel at this point what's dictating filmmakers' choices is almost those expectations more than a concern of historical accuracy. For example, I think you could do one that was truly accurate or more accurate, let's say, and still have it be quite dramatic. But it might not include a couple of these cliched elements that everyone is used to expecting. I mean, I think if you actually emphasize very strongly the discipline of the Roman army and showed, you know, the people working together and that interplay between comrades alongside each other in the line, in the formation, you could infuse that with a lot of drama. And so I think there's a lot of room in real ancient history to infuse things that are extremely dramatic into films, but people just haven't done it yet. And it almost takes on this kind of unfortunate weight where, well, it hasn't been done before, so we can't do it now. We just have to keep remaking the same movie over and over again.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about how the real world of ancient Rome compares to movies about ancient Rome over the years. The sequel to Gladiator will open next month, and we figured that's a good enough excuse to talk about all of this. Gregory Aldrete isn't at all a buzzkill when he talks about the historical accuracy of period films. It's a movie. He gets it because he's a movie lover. But he does always hope filmmakers will at least make an effort.
What interests me about seeing ancient Rome depicted on film is really two things coming together. One, of course, I'm a professional Roman historian, so I have an interest in this, but completely separate. Long before actually I became interested in Roman history, I was a fan of cinema. I was that kid in college who would go to the Film Society films and watch weird foreign movies and stuff. And so this naturally is an overlap. Well, how has my own field been depicted in this area that I care so much about? And this book on films set in ancient Rome, I think of this as my COVID book, because when COVID struck and all of us were confined to our homes for about a year, what my wife and I did is over the course of that year, 2020, we sat down and watched 50 films or miniseries set in ancient Rome.
Wow.
So it was kind of a chance to just revisit ones I knew before, see some I hadn't seen but had always intended to see, catch up on others. And of course, once we started doing this, we start talking about them. And so that was the origin of it. And the other thing that intersected there is honestly one of the most common questions I would get when I'm just, you know, in the market or on an airplane or something, and you're making conversation with strangers and I say I'm a Roman historian. I'd say at least half the time, the very first thing they would do is ask me about how accurate is this movie? Yeah. I love such and such a movie.
Yeah.
So it's clearly something that the general public wants to know. They want to know, here's a film I love. I've had a long relationship with it. It's meant something to me. It has stirred me emotionally. How accurate is it as history? And the book is kind of an attempt to answer that.
So you get the question of all the time, how true is this film that I love to the actual history about Rome? And here's the question, does it matter? Does it matter if it is true to history?
Yeah, this is the classic response. You take something fun and hand it to an academic and they ruin it, right? So I love this movie and, you know, they're just going to sort of, you know,
you're going to ruin it for me.
Criticize and say it's terrible. Yeah. That's right. That's right. In a sense, there are no bad Roman movies in my mind because even the most historically inaccurate film will spark someone's interest. And if that spark leads them to read something about Rome, watch a video, watch a documentary, watch another movie, to me, that's a win. So anything that encourages the public to engage with ancient history, I think is terrific. I mean, I believe that's part of my mission is to try to explain to people in general, not just my students, why history is important, why it matters, and how it's relevant directly to their lives, even if it's ancient history. Mm-hmm. And film does that. Now, within that, we can, of course, say, well, some do a better or worse job depicting antiquity.
But I don't want to be one of those academics who just says, oh, this film is horrible. It makes so many mistakes. I don't want to think about it.
Yeah.
So in the sense of getting people interested in a topic, that's fantastic. Then we can move to the next stage, which is, well, what does it do good? What does it do bad? What's important there?
I want to talk about Ben-Hur. Let's sort of start there with actual films, at least the version from 1925, because there are a few versions. We'll get to the one from 1959 that a lot of us know so well with Charlton Heston. But let's talk about the first version, which you say it was the most expensive silent film ever made, I guess. Pretty ambitious.
At the time, yeah. So the 1959 version of Charlton Heston copies this one very closely.
Yeah.
But it was an important film for setting this model of taking a popular novel and turning it into a Roman movie. Ben-Hur was a wildly popular bestseller. It had spawned this very extremely popular theater version, which traveled across the country, and they would have live horses on stage running on treadmills for the chariot scene.
Wow.
So this was something that at the time was really a cultural phenomenon. So they were taking something that was very popular and then sort of translating it into this new media of cinema. And it's also, of course, has these rousing sequences of especially the chariot race and the naval battle. So it's that big spectacle, you know, violence, action, drama, all that wrapped up together.
Well, let's talk about, as you say, there are those two iconic set pieces that Ben, this particular film, you said, established these patterns that we'll see well into the future about ancient Rome. So you've got the naval battle, you've got the chariot race. Let's talk about the naval battle first. We'll come back to the chariot racing part a little bit later. There are these scenes where we see, I think people know this particular part of the naval battle, where you have these ranks of slaves who are straining on oars in a dank galley of a ship, you know, rowing in unison. The strokes are, you know, beat out by this drum. Start there. How accurate is that part?
Well, Ben-Hur, the central character, is accused of committing a crime, which he actually didn't do. And as punishment, he's condemned to row in the Roman galleys.
Yeah.
So he's sent to the galleys as punishment. And there's this notion this is a standard punishment in the Roman world. And this is an indelible image of both slavery and of sort of Roman naval warfare. And it's certainly true that ships of this era and earlier and later eras as well were propelled by these hundreds of people pulling on oars. The interesting thing about that, though, is that they weren't slaves.
Yeah.
So this one of the most iconic things that comes from this movie and the later one is this notion that, you know, if you misbehave in the Roman Empire, if you're found guilty of a crime, you'll be sent to the galleys. This has become almost a pop culture cliche, and it just isn't true. The Romans employed free men as rowers, and they paid them a wage. And this was not, you know, particularly high status job, but it wasn't a shameful one either. So that's the big ahistorical element, and it's a really major one because I think these films have just cemented in everyone's minds that this was an aspect of life in the Roman Empire.
I want to ask you about the way Christians interact with Romans in these films in Hollywood. Let's talk about the sign of the cross.
Rome will be destroyed when I die. Why not when I live and can see it?
Burn, Rome! Burn!
Couldn't we shift the blame to the Christians?
This is Cecil B. DeMille's 1932 film. And you say in the book that this film really kind of cemented in place this formula for films, which involved this two stereotypes, I think is how you say. You've got on one hand the arrogant, decadent Roman, and then on the other is the devout, you know, pious Christian. Talk about that a template that you've noticed in these films.
The basic one is that the conflict is between the Romans, who are corrupt and decadent and kind of arrogant, and a band of Christians who are the heroes and are virtuous and good. And almost always there is a Roman military figure, an officer, who falls in love with the virtuous Christian girl and ends up being converted. So right. This is the love story at the center of it. That gets repeated many times as well. This film initiates that, and it also initiates the depiction of usually a crazy emperor, who becomes the focal point of a lot of the dramatic action. So in this case, it's Nero, again, one of the kind of, you know, allegedly crazy emperors played by Charles Laughton, very memorably.
Yeah.
Later versions of this kind of trope, you have Peter Ustinov, who does the same thing really wonderfully in a later version. So you have all these stereotypes, and they all become standard tropes. But I think this is a way for an audience to both watch these sort of extremely lurid scenes and to watch the violence of the gladiator games, particularly, while at the same time saying, well, I'm identifying with the Christians, so it's okay. And it almost gives you permission to indulge in this sort of thing, because officially you're on the side of the good people who are against this. But really what you want to see is a lot of dramatic action spectacles. So this film introduces all of this. It has, you know, the fire of Rome, where Rome burns while Nero kind of celebrates or performs a musical performance. It has some quite graphic scenes with gladiators fighting, with wild beasts sort of trampling or killing people, and of course with Christians being executed.
Yeah.
And another cliche that this film really cements is this notion that the Romans as a society, even in the first century AD when most of them are set, were really obsessed with the persecution of Christians. And that's a little bit of a historical misrepresentation. There certainly were Christians who were martyred, absolutely. And there were many who were killed in extremely cruel ways. But it wasn't this all-consuming obsession that you see in these films of the Romans saying, I want to kill me some Christians today. That's what I think about when I get up in the morning.
That's Gregory Aldrete. He's a professor emeritus of history and humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. Along with Graham Sumner, he wrote the book Ancient Rome on the Silver Screen, Myth versus Reality. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Next month, the director Ridley Scott is releasing a sequel to his film Gladiator. And whenever a filmmaker tackles a subject from history, the questions of accuracy and authenticity always come up. Scott has said he's creating fiction, not practicing archaeology, so he feels perfectly free to take creative license on some of the details. Today in the program, we have with us the historian and movie buff Gregory Aldrete, talking about how Hollywood gets ancient Rome right and wrong. Let's talk about the kind of great golden age of these, I think as you put it in the book, the sword and sandal movies. What was it about the 1950s that really, where people really wanted to see, you know, men in short tunics with sandals? Like, what was it about that time that people really connected to ancient Rome?
I think it's a whole bunch of things. Yeah. I mean, one is there's just fads in filmmaking. So certain films are popular, and then there's too many of them in other types. So there's an era when Westerns dominate, and then they pass out of popularity, and then historical films dominate, and, you know, science fiction films, fantasy, whatever. But there are some interesting themes that run throughout some of the 50s era movies. For example, when I talk about professional historians writing historical books, one of the themes is that often a book will tell you more about the time it's written than the subject that it's written about.
Hmm.
And I think that's certainly true with movies. So Quo Vadis comes along right after World War II. I think it's 1951 the film comes out. And you can see a lot of influences of World War II themes, and particularly the United States in the post-war world, as trying to find its place. We're now you know, sort of have an American empire. We've just defeated Nazi Germany. What are we going to do? And you can see many of these themes sort of manifesting themselves in the film. So there's a number of ways in which the evil Romans in the film are made parallel to Nazis, even just the way that they dress or the use of the sort of fascist salute, very much recalling, for example, stormtroopers in Hitler's Germany or something like that. So yeah, you have all these kinds of scenes and deliberate callbacks to this.
There's one moment I think quite interesting that you mention in Ben-Hur, the 1959 version of Ben-Hur. There's this scene where Messala is urging Judah, played by Charlton Heston, to name disloyal Jews. And he refuses to sort of point them out.
You may conquer the land, you may slaughter the people, but that is not the end. We will rise again.
You live on dead dreams. You live on the myths of the past. The glory of Solomon is gone. Do you think it will return? Joshua will not rise again to save you, nor David. There is only one reality in the world today. Look to the west, Judah. Don't be a fool. Look to Rome.
I would rather be a fool than a traitor or a killer.
I am a soldier.
Yes, who kills for Rome.
And Rome is evil.
I warn you.
No!
I warn you. Rome is an affront to God. Rome is strangling my people and my country, the whole earth. Forever. If I tell you the day Rome falls, there will be a shout of freedom such as the world has never heard before.
This gets to something you mention in the book, that one of the characteristics of these films in this era is having the stories, as you say, function as a mirror to reflect what's happening at the moment. And there you go, sort of the McCarthy era of, I suppose that's what's playing out in that scene. Is that's what you're seeing there?
Yeah, so absolutely. In a lot of these films, there are echoes of the late 1950s, early 1960s McCarthy communist hunts where they're trying to identify people who are communists. And in Hollywood, a number of famous directors and writers get blacklisted because they're allegedly communists. And there's all these hearings where they haul people of all kinds before committees and ask them questions. And one of the scenes that's added to the 1950 Ben-Hur that's not in the earlier film, that is not in the novel. Yeah. So this is something they put in just for the 50s version, is a scene where the Roman administrator tries to pressure Ben-Hur to name disloyal Jews who are disloyal to the Roman Empire. And that is obviously an explicit reference to what's going on in the news at the time this film was being made, where people were being pressured to name supposed communists. So yes, that's a perfect example of the way often these films mirror in the film what's going on in real life at the time the film is being made.
So we talked about those two great sort of iconic set pieces. There's the naval battle, which we talked about. Let's talk about the chariot race in Ben-Hur. I guess the first question is, did the Romans have chariot races? I suppose the answer is yes, as you've already sort of said. But let's talk about how they worked. Like, what were they like?
The funny thing is that the chariot race in both the 50s and the 20s version of the film for MGM both times was directed by the same guy.
Right.
So William Wyler is the director of the 1959 film, and he was one of the assistant directors in the earlier film, not the main director. But his main task as an assistant director was to do the chariot race. So basically, he directed the same guy both of those sequences. And this is, especially in the 1959 film, one of the most famous action sequences in all of film history. And honestly, I think that sort of 10-minute chariot race in the 1959 film is a really great action sequence. I show that to my class in my Roman history classes.
Huh.
And it is a depiction of a Roman chariot race. And the Romans did indeed have chariot races. And in fact, chariot racing was probably the most popular sport in ancient Rome, spectator sport. So we tend to think of the Romans spending all their time in gladiator games. That's a little bit of a misconception. Gladiator games were comparatively very rare. Chariot racing, on the other hand, happened dozens of times per year. And the venue, the Circus Maximus, where it occurred, could hold at least 250,000 spectators.
Wow.
So in terms of what it is that the average Roman spent a lot of time watching and following, it's overwhelmingly chariot racing more than gladiator games. And the film does a wonderful job of recreating a Roman chariot race. So they actually built a full-size circus. Yeah. So it's this long oval with a divider down the middle called the spina, the spine, and the chariots race around this oval. And so they actually constructed this set at Cinecittà Studios outside of Rome. And again, in the both versions, the 20s and the 1959 version, there's no sort of special effects. These are real horses, real chariots, real people driving them. And it was mostly, of course, stuntmen, but they had to have some scenes where the actors were in the chariots. And so they sent all the actors to sort of chariot racing driving school. So Charlton Heston, Stephen Boyd, all those guys had to actually learn how to do this. And in terms of what it gets right, I think what it gets right is the excitement of chariot racing and the danger.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have those camera angles where you just see the galloping horses, you know, with the hooves pounding. And when they get to the ends of the spine, the spina, how the chariots have to slew around, you know, a 180-degree turn and often collide or hit one another. And that's all absolutely accurate. So chariot racing in ancient Rome was not as violent as gladiator games, but it was a violent sport in which death and injury were common. We have many, many tombstones from Roman charioteers that say, you know, they raced for 6 years and then died in a crash in the circus. And often they're teenagers. So, wow. You know, they start racing at 13, maybe crash and die at 19 or something. So this was a really hazardous sport. And the race captures that. I mean, a typical race, most of the people might not finish. You know, they wouldn't necessarily all die, but they would crash. So all of that is captured very well in the film. Now, the major non-historical element in Ben-Hur
is
that in Ben-Hur, the chariots... Well, there's two. There's okay. two oh, non-historical okay. elements. Okay. One is the blades.
Yeah.
So one is the fact that the Roman, who's the villain in the movie... Messala, his chariot is equipped with some blades on the wheels that spin around, and he literally dices up some of the other chariots. And that did not happen in real Roman chariot racing. It was quite violent enough, thank you very much. And the second big inaccuracy from a historical standpoint is in Ben-Hur, the charioteers all compete representing different nations or ethnicities or cities. In reality, that's not how chariot races worked. In reality, there were professional teams. And really, there were only four main teams who were color-coded. It was the blues, the greens, the reds, and the whites. Huh. And a chariot race would feature usually three chariots from each of the four teams. So you would have three white chariots, three blue, three green. And those chariots would work together during the race. So the three blue chariots would sort of coordinate their efforts. So just like football or something today, there were these professional teams, and the average Roman would pick one of those teams or factions that he would follow. He would be an absolutely fanatical fan. So on race day, you know, if you were a fan of the greens, you would dress all in green. You'd go to the stadium. You'd sit with other greens. You would yell insulting things to the blues. You'd get into fights with the people of other factions. And you really lived and died with the fortunes of your team. They were pretty fanatical in antiquity. That's not a modern thing.
Gregory Aldrey, what's going on in the 1960s through 1980 in terms of these films? This is a really interesting time that you write about. You've got Fellini and you've got Bob Guccione and you have the Pythons, Monty Python. How do you describe this era in film?
Yeah, so I mean, the history of film set in ancient Rome is you have sort of the original era back in the black and white. You have the pre-Hays Code. You have some others. There's a little bit of a gap in the 40s, and then the 50s and early 60s, you have that kind of golden era where you have, you know, Spartacus, Ben-Hur, Quo Vadis, all those big films, and they're very popular. And then they crash. So you have Cleopatra, which was a financial disaster. You have the fall of the Roman Empire, which was a financial disaster. And so at that point, the big studios turn away from making big budget films set in the ancient world. And also it just gotten a little bit stale. You know, they'd gotten a little bit too cliched. And so then you enter the 60s and the 70s, where nobody is making big budget, you know, films about the ancient world. But it almost, it's a very fascinating time because it opens up space for all kinds of more individualistic personal takes on the ancient world, which go in all directions. So early on, you have a number of comic parodies. So you have this film, Carry On Cleo, which is a Cleopatra parody done in England. You have A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum,
right,
which is, again, a comic take on Roman plays. You have, you know, Mel Brooks doing History of the World Part One. And, of course, you have Monty Python doing Life of Brian, which is actually a very intelligent parody of Bible movies and antiquity in general. So you have that whole parody group. Then you also have TV starting to become a media. So you have I, Claudius, which was made by the BBC and PBS in the US as a co-production and was kind of a unexpected success, where people really got hooked on this very kind of literate, very talky version of ancient Rome, where there's almost no physical action, but it's hour after hour of these sort of Shakespearean British actors just talking to one another. But it's riveting, you know, so that's a new way to depict the ancient world. It's not about spectacle. It's about this kind of intellectual conversation.
We don't have to spend much time with Life of Brian, but it does bring up the quote that you mentioned in the book. Apart from the sanitation, medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, the fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, the fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
Brought peace?
Oh, peace! Shut up!
Maybe you can say something about the way the Pythons sort of got at least this part quite right.
Monty Python, actually, they're very knowing about history, the members of the comedy troupe. Some of them are history majors and things. And Life of Brian has some extremely smart little bits in which they address huge, important debates even among historians in a kind of comic way. So the most famous of these is the scene where, you know, the people's front of Judea is gathered right around and ranting about all the terrible things about the Romans. And in a kind of rhetorical way, the leader says, you know, what have the Romans ever done for us? And of course, one of them pipes up and says, you know, the aqueduct and another sanitation and the roads and peace and all these other things. And you end up with this long list of wonderful things the Romans have brought to Judea. And of course, this makes the leader very angry. But in that, you know, maybe 30-second little snippet,
yeah,
what the Pythons are really exploring is a truly fundamental question about the Roman Empire, which is what are the effects of Romanization on the areas that are conquered by Rome? Mm. So on the one hand, you know, if you're a provincial area and you're conquered by Rome, you know, you suffer invasion and murder and enslavement in some cases and theft. But on the other hand, the Romans bring, quote, civilization, however you might define that. And in this case, they're defining it by these various specific things. And this is a real debate. I mean, when a place was conquered by Rome and was Romanized, were they better or worse off? And this is the kind of thing Roman historians like to debate about. It's also really getting to the heart of the interaction of civilizations. So when two civilizations come together and one is conquered by the other, the conquered civilization is going to lose some of its aspects. Some of its things will be suppressed or will disappear. But on the other hand, it'll gain new things. It'll gain, you know, exposure to maybe more economic opportunities or to cultural ideas or to philosophy. So all of that gets encapsulated in this very incredibly brief and very funny little bit about, you know, basically what happens with the ancient version of globalization. And that's where it also has relevance to today is, you know, nowadays you have, let's say, Western culture, even American culture kind of taking over and everywhere has a McDonald's. And, you know, is this a horrible, horrible thing that local businesses are being driven out? Or is it a good thing that there's this kind of uniformity everywhere and things that you know what to expect. And maybe McDonald's isn't the greatest example there to use. But you know, it is a question about globalization. I mean, both the positive and negative effects of spreading one culture over others, and what's lost there and what's gained. And all of that is in that little tiny clip from Monty Python. They're very good at this.
That's the historian Gregory Aldrete. Along with the illustrator Graham Sumner, he wrote the book Ancient Rome on the Silver Screen, Myth versus Reality. Take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about historical accuracy in the movies. The movies about ancient Rome in particular. There's a sequel to Ridley Scott's incredibly popular 2000 film Gladiator coming next month. So we asked the historian Gregory Aldrete to join us. Now, he's not a killjoy, but he does want directors to at least make an effort. His book is called Ancient Rome on the Silver Screen, Myth versus Reality. Okay, let's come back to Gladiator, Ridley Scott's film from 2000. You say that the film really marked a new era, that he kind of single-handedly revived the big-budget ancient history epic. Say more about that.
The big-budget Hollywood epic set in the ancient world had died in the early 60s, particularly with Cleopatra and the fall of the Roman Empire, which were both disasters. And that scared off everyone. So for about 35 years or so, they weren't making these big films. And then finally, in 2000, Ridley Scott, the director, makes Gladiator, and it's a huge success, both financially and critically. Wins a bunch of Academy Awards, does extremely well at the box office. And this ushers in the next big era of ancient films. So not just Roman ones, but things set in ancient Greece. You have Alexander, you have 300, you have all these other movies coming out.
Yeah.
And it kind of revives this notion of the big epic. And of course, later this year, Gladiator 2. So we're going to see more of this. But it really does start this new era. And Gladiator, ironically, is a remake of the film that killed the earlier era, The Fall of the Roman Empire. So it changes some things, but the basic plot centered around the emperor Marcus Aurelius and who will take over after his death is the same. And of course, Marcus Aurelius is one of the more famous Roman emperors. He's this guy who was thought of as the philosopher emperor. He was an adherent of the Stoic school of philosophy. He wrote this little book, The Meditations, which people still read today and find very inspirational. And he was conventionally regarded as one of the good emperors of Rome. And in the second century AD, Rome had a succession of these good emperors. It's thought of as the golden age of Rome. And the reason it was a golden age is because when each emperor came to pick his successor, rather than just handing off the empire to his son or to a male relative, which is what emperors had done previously and had resulted in lots of crazy emperors, instead they sort of looked around, picked the best qualified person, and adopted that person as his son.
Right.
And in real life, what Marcus Aurelius, supposedly this wise philosopher emperor, does is he looks around and says, oh, what do you know? The best qualified guy is my own dear son, Commodus.
Right.
And he picks his son, Commodus, to be emperor, and Commodus goes crazy and murders people and does all that stuff. And so this is often seen as a turning point in Roman history. That from this point on, even though Rome lasts for a while, it's all downhill. So that's why the old film in the 60s is called The Fall of the Roman Empire. It's the beginning of the downward slide for Rome. And what both that film and Gladiator hypothesize fictitiously, this has no basis in reality, is that Marcus Aurelius, being a wise philosopher, didn't really want to hand off the emperor to his son Commodus, but really wanted to give it to a noble, virtuous general. In Gladiator, it's Maximus, played by Russell Crowe.
Tell me about your home.
My house is in the hills above Tehillo. Very simple place. Pink stones that warm in the sun. Kitchen garden that smells of herbs in the day. Jasmine in the evening.
Now, in real life, there was no Maximus. Marcus Aurelius very much and very clearly wanted to give it to his son. He did everything he could to hand the empire to his son Commodus.
Let's talk about the gladiator part of the film and how accurate that is. Let's start with the gladiator school, which in the film is in this sort of backwater town in North Africa. It's led by Oliver Reed has a great role here, Antonius Proximo. Did they get that part right? Were there gladiator schools?
Yes. So Maximus basically gets sold as a slave and sold to a gladiator school. And one of the great things about Gladiator, the 2000 movie, is that it has him ending up in this provincial, small town, little gladiator school in North Africa. And this is actually something I really like about the film, because typically films about gladiators focus almost exclusively on Rome. And that is where, you know, the Colosseum was. It's where most gladiator games took place. But every little Roman town of, you know, any town that thought of itself as anything would have had a little miniature amphitheater and would have held small town gladiator games. And so it's really great that we see this very small town in North Africa having its own little gladiator games and having its local gladiator school. Now, where the movie falls down is in most other ways it depicts gladiators.
Right.
And the first of them is that almost every fight ended in a death. Recently, some scholar did a study of, I think there's about 100 fights from the first and second century AD that we know some degree of detail about. Huh. And I think only about 10% of them resulted in the death of one of the combatants. So that's probably a more realistic figure for how often someone died in a gladiator contest. Secondly, the gladiators were highly trained professionals. So in the film, they kind of throw Maximus and the other gladiators. They literally throw them into the ring with no training, nothing whatsoever, and almost all of them get killed immediately, and there's this big battle. I mean, gladiators were very professional warriors. They would have received months and months of specialized training before they ever set foot in an arena. They were valuable. Hmm. And the way to think of gladiators is they were kind of like boxers. You know, I mean, they're people who train for a very long time before you really get into the ring. Bouts between two fighters were just two people fighting. So the other thing you see in a lot of gladiator movies, including Gladiator, is they'll put, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 gladiators in at once, all just beating on one another.
Yeah.
Gladiator fights were one-on-one combats. So you would go to see a series of fights between two individuals who are paired up of similar skill. So it wasn't an experienced gladiator versus a novice like you tend to see in movies. It was two guys who were thought to be pretty evenly matched. And it was meant to be an exhibition of skill, not just sort of a bloodbath. So you don't get a lot of sense of that in Gladiator the movie. But there were these schools, and the gladiators were technically slaves. So they were a very despised class, but at the same time, they were admired. I mean, they could become celebrities. And so this is kind of interesting, because here we have someone who, in legal terms, is at the bottom of Roman society.
Yeah.
He's a slave. But in status terms, is much higher. So, I mean, this is something historians call status dissonance, where your real status is not in line with your legal status. And gladiators are a particularly interesting example of this phenomenon, because it's something that made the Romans uneasy. They didn't like this idea that, oh, well, gladiators, sure, they're popular, but they're technically performing for our pleasure and are slaves. And that created some tension within Roman society.
So you mention in the book that Ridley Scott's Gladiator, the one in 2000, was this significant moment in the history of cinema and for films that would be set in ancient Rome. I don't know if you know anything about Gladiator 2, which is coming. What are you hoping for or expecting in that story, in that film?
Good question. I mean, I don't have any real insider knowledge of the new Gladiator. I actually know the historical consultant who worked on the first film, who had a negative experience working with Ridley Scott, where they kind of ignored her advice, and eventually she has to have her name taken off the film credits as historical consultant. So I don't have any insider knowledge of the new film. I'm curious to see what they do. I mean, I'm curious to see how they take the plot. I'm curious to see how they depict things. From the few little, you know, trailers and stuff that I've seen, it looks like they're continuing the sorts of trends they had in the first film, which is to make to not worry about the historical accuracy of the gladiator scenes, kind of just make that up.
Yeah.
Another problem with the first gladiator is that real Roman gladiators all fought as very specific types. So there were, you know, 20 or 30 different types of gladiators. You would train as this one type. It would have very specific equipment that you used. So the most famous example is the retiarius, the guy who had a trident in one hand and a net in the other. So he's a fisherman. He's meant to be like a fisherman who'd try and entangle an opponent and spear him with the trident. In the original gladiator, they didn't try to replicate that at all. I mean, the gladiators just fight with the most random assortment of armor and weapons I've ever seen. And I think they look like they're continuing that in the next film. So we'll see. I'm curious to find out what happens. I don't know a lot about the movie, but I'll certainly go watch it. And like I said at the beginning, anything that raises interest in ancient Rome, I think is good and will hopefully at least lead people to learn more about ancient history.
Final question. So we're in this era of, you know, premium television series and big CGI blockbusters. Do you think there's still a future for big budget history epics about Rome?
I think there is. And I think there's a lot of stories that would be very good stories that haven't been told. I mean, probably the big one that actually many people have tried to make and really haven't is the story of Hannibal. So he's the kind of arch enemy of Rome, the Carthaginian general who crosses the Alps with elephants and defeats a whole bunch of Roman armies. There have been a couple lowish budget things and a couple miniseries made about him, but he's a fantastic story. And no one's really done a big budget Hollywood epic. Vin Diesel wanted to make one a few years ago, but it came to nothing. There are these terrific stories in Roman history that I think haven't been told. And there's ways to tell sort of obscure bits of Roman history and make them interesting. The very last film I talk about in the book is this Italian film from 2020 called The First King, which goes back to the very dawn of Rome, to the mythological foundation story of Romulus and Remus, who are these supposedly twin sons of the god Mars, who literally found the city of Rome. And it was an interesting take to actually go back to that period and, instead of treating it in a mythic fashion, try to treat it in an ultra-realistic fashion. So Romulus and Remus, the founders of Rome, instead of being this glorious thing, are leading a band of sort of outcasts from other cities through a swamp. And that's actually what the ancient accounts tell us. I mean, the original followers of Romulus and Remus were these sort of outcasts from other cities. And they did start out with this very humble beginnings. And archaeological evidence has shown that the first buildings at Rome were these kind of just simple mud huts with this wooden post construction. So, I mean, that's a vision of Rome that we really haven't seen depicted, certainly not in a realistic way, but people are doing. So I think there's a lot of room to make interesting stories about Rome, filling in some of the gaps we haven't seen on screen yet, telling some of the stories that we haven't seen. And I think there's a lot more to be done with even stories about common Romans. So not even the famous ones, but to do, you know, more about that daily life stuff and show us what drama was like if you're, you know, someone who just works on a merchant ship taking grain across the ocean and you have to worry about being attacked by pirates and, you know, there's fraud and government corruption and all sorts of things that would be familiar today. There's stories about, I was just writing an article about sort of con men in antiquity. And that's something we tend to think of as a modern phenomenon. But we have all these stories of people who practiced insurance fraud in antiquity. And that's probably not a good movie. But there was another guy who actually founded a false religious cult. and had like a little fake snake god that he had literally a puppet head that would, you know, sort of tell oracles to people. And it became this popular religious cult. And this was during the Roman Empire. So there's a lot of things about ancient Rome I think people haven't seen that would make compelling watching. So probably we'll get more epics. We'll get more remakes of Ben-Hur. We'll get more movies about Cleopatra. But maybe they can weave into those stories some of these other aspects that I think would be people would actually maybe find interesting.
Well, Gregory Aldrete, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks. It was fun.
That's Gregory Aldrete. He's a professor emeritus of history and humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. Along with the illustrator Graham Sumner, he wrote the book Ancient Rome on the Silver Screen, Myth versus Reality. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. Our intern is Stevie Shaughnessy, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.